Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Before we get to our guest tonight, we want to quickly go back to our breaking news from earlier in the newscast, the resignation of Prince George's County Police Chief Hank Stawinski. This comes after additional accusations of discrimination against officers of color were filed in a legal brief today. Joining me on the WHUR News live line is County Police Captain Joe Perez. He's also president of the Hispanic National Law Enforcement Association and a party to the lawsuit. Captain Perez, thanks for joining us. Share with me what your reaction is to Chief Stawinski's resignation.
Well, I think this is only the beginning, and we've got much more work to do in order to make things right in the department.
What impact might you think this could have on the lawsuit, and what do you want to see happen moving forward?
Well, first of all, I'd like to see a chief take over that's culturally competent, you know, who's willing to work with us, who's willing to listen and to take suggestions on how to make the department better. And, you know, we're hoping that we can now move forward because Chief Stawinski was setting the tone of, you know, discrimination and retaliation against anyone that exposed wrongdoing. So I think it's a start, and we've got much more work to do.
Officers who were demoted, such as yourself, who are still with the department, do you want to be reinstated to previous positions? Do you think that would be part of what would be needed to address this issue?
Well, I've since retired, and my case is under appeal with the circuit court. And yes, I do expect them to, you know, make me whole again.
Well, indeed, we will continue to watch this. And again, there will be a press conference tomorrow with County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. That's slated for 12 noon. And of course, we will be covering that as well. Captain Perez, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate you.
All right. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, now to the Insight segment. All week long, we're having conversations about race relations and racial injustice in America. And tonight we will speak with a progressive firebrand, outspoken on those very issues and the author of a very relevant memoir. My guest is Bakari Sellers, CNN political commentator and author of the new book, My Vanishing Country. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Bakari Sellers, thanks for joining the conversation. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And it looks like you guys are having some interesting conversations up there. I was happy to be on the phone and listen in to the changes that are happening and how you're covering them. So thank you for giving me a platform, and thank you for covering the breaking needed news up there.
Absolutely. That is our wheelhouse. And certainly this is the time when, you know, certainly people like yourself and our organization, Black Media, are very, very relevant, perhaps even more than ever before. I want to talk about some of those issues right now. Let's talk about some of the headlines. Right now, we have one of the officers involved in the Rashard Brooks killing behind bars. You have another released on bond. Your response to the events of the past 24 hours in the Rashard Brooks case?
And you have in Atlanta Zone 1 last night only one sergeant or two sergeants and a couple of patrol officers show up for duty.
Yeah.
You know, the rest called out with what they now call the blue flu. So, you know, I think that right now what we're having in this country is a reckoning. And I think that and I urge those people who are in general assemblies and those people who are in county seats and local seats of government, as well as the United States Congress. As King said, it's the fierce urgency of now. People are no longer waiting until November. We have to take action today to improve relationships to reform and reimagine policing in this country. And that is probably what we're seeing throughout in all of these departments.
Mm-hmm. One of the other interesting things that happened today, and I'm sure you have your ear to the ground on this, Mary Elizabeth Taylor, a Black Republican, Assistant Secretary of State for Legislative Affairs, resigned. And in her resignation letter, she said that the president's actions cut sharply against her core values and convictions. And she was speaking about the president's handling of racial tensions across the country. And as you also know, that the president, during an interview with the Wall Street Journal today, said that he made Juneteenth famous and that no one had heard about it until he had asked a Black Secret Service agent. Dare I ask you the question, what's going on here?
No, I can't tell you about that. I don't know why I would have expectations for this man. You know, in South Carolina, we had this saying, we just say, bless your heart. You know, and when somebody from South Carolina tells you, bless your heart, that is as visceral as we can possibly be. You know, the president of the United States will take credit for Juneteenth, and soon he will tell us that he actually freed slaves. You know, I don't have any expectation for him. But what I do want to say is that it's incumbent upon all those people around him, those people who we view to be good, those people who we've characterized as being good, and I know I'm going to get a lot of chatter about that, but it's incumbent upon somebody around him to step up, and it's incumbent upon all of us to step up and adhere to that fierce urgency of now as we prepare for November.
Can we just say thank God for the Black Secret Service agent? Always there for a teachable moment. How about that?
Always there for a teachable moment. I am ecstatic that Donald Trump at 70 some odd years old learned in his 70s about Juneteenth. Something that most Black folks have known our entire life.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking to CNN commentator Bakari Sellers. He also is the author of a new memoir, My Vanishing Country. If you have a comment or a question for him, please give us a call. We invite you to join the conversation. Talk to me a little bit about My Vanishing Country. And why it fascinates me that this book has come out at such an important time in American history, and yet this is your personal story.
I mean, let me be honest with you. When you write a book, there are two things that are true. One, you don't control when it comes out or when it's released, unless you're, you know, Barack Obama, whose book is coming out in the fall when he's ready for it to come out, right? And two, you never want your book to come out during the middle of a pandemic. this is the first book tour, I think, that anybody's ever been on that I haven't had to wear pants the entire tour. I just show up in my laptop and sit in front of my computer the whole time. But, you know, God works in mysterious ways. And my book came out on May 19th, which is also Malcolm X Day. And we had a great amount of sales and momentum. People like Tyler Perry and T.D. Jakes, Hillary Clinton, Charlemagne the God, all were very supportive. And then, you know, I say that this book is evergreen because it talks about systemic and institutionalized racism through my eyes and through the story of my life. And I talk about, you know, state-sanctioned violence against people of color. And here we are in a pandemic when my book is released, and that there are these huge disparities with people of color. And then we have Breonna, Ahmaud, we have George Floyd, we have David McAtee, and now we have Rashard Brooks down in Atlanta. You know, I could have never predicted that, but actually I think the tragedy is I think I could have predicted that, because if the book would have come out 4 months earlier or 4 months later, we would have still been talking about systemic injustice and institutionalized racism. And we would have still had more young Black people who were dead in the streets. And so I think this is evergreen, but we are in a moment. We're in an inflection period. And My Vanishing Country is my story. And I know we're going to have questions about how somebody 35 years old writes a memoir. Well, you know, when you read the story and you hear about February 8th of 1968, where my father was shot, and 28 others were injured and three were killed on the campus of South Carolina State, and that activism and the impact on my family to becoming the youngest black elected official in the country, or a 30-year-old nominee for lieutenant governor, all the way through, 5 years ago yesterday, suffering the greatest tragedy that I've felt in my chest. My good friend Clemente Pinckney was killed along with eight others in Mother Emanuel Amy Church. That's the story of my life, and it's also the story of being black in America, that pain and trauma. But it's also one of hope and perseverance, and so I'm grateful to share that story with the world. And, I'm just fortunate enough that it's a bestseller now, New York Times bestseller, and we want to keep the momentum going.
Let's talk a little bit, if we can, about that father's piece. This is a Father's Day weekend coming up. My father, God bless him, is alive and kicking, just not kicking quite as high. And for black fathers in this time, you could almost argue that this is the most critical time for the leadership of black fathers who may be fearing not only for themselves, but fearing for their sons and their daughters and their families. Talk to me a little bit about where we are with black fathers. Because you're a new father.
I am. You just heard my kids in the background a little bit earlier. I have 17-month-old twins and a 15-year-old daughter. I'm her bonus dad, as we call it around here. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what I'm doing with a 15-year-old daughter. So if somebody just wants to call in to give me some tips, I will write them down and take them.
We can talk later. Mine will be 22 on Monday, so we can talk.
Did aliens come down about 12 or 13 and replace your daughter? And did they eventually bring her back? Because I don't know what's going on right now. But it's 15 is anything, I'll tell you that. And then I have 17-month-old twins. And, I write about the story of my wife last January when the twins were born, having to fight for her life. And you talk about fatherhood. My wife almost died in childbirth, like many black women. And, black women are, four times more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts. And that, I had to be her advocate. I had to stand up and advocate and yell and scream and get her the care she needed, because black women across socioeconomic levels, that is probably one of the only health outcomes in this country that crosses socioeconomic levels. It's African-American female mortality. And she almost died. She lost 7 units of blood. She hemorrhaged in the first 36 hours of our children's life. She was in ICU on a ventilator. And then 2 months later, my little girl was diagnosed with biliary atresia, which is a very rare liver disorder. So last year, September 1st, she had to have a liver transplant. She got the gift of life. And so being a father, my wife would, she would just ask me sometimes at night, would God give us this beautiful girl just to take her away from us? And you have to be strong for your wife. You have to be strong for, you have 3 children, and you have to do everything you can, even though you go on the closet or in the shower and you cry. And then you think about it. And just recently I had a moment on CNN. I was coming on TV after George Floyd's brother was on, and I had a moment where I cried on TV. And just the difficulty of raising black children in this environment, in this America, is something that haunts me. And I don't know if anybody else is haunted by it, but I was on with Steve Harvey earlier today. Steve and I, he has a mentoring camp, and I was glad to be a part of it. We were having a camp with 1,000 kids, black men around this country, and we were just talking about conversations that just to be blunt, white folk don't have to have with their kids. And so to be a father right now, this is I know, 1968 when my father was shot in the Orangeburg massacre, that was in February. In April you had King getting assassinated. In June you had RFK. You had soldiers coming home from Vietnam. That's the only time that in history that I can equate with what's happening now. And black men are needed more than ever. And what has to happen, to be honest, is that me and you and those of us who have a platform, we're going to have to take off our ties. We got to take off our scrubs. We got to take off this suit that we put on every day, and we got to go meet our brothers where they are. and we have to uplift them and talk to them and encourage them and make them a part of the process. For far too long, many of our brothers have been ignored, and we have to lift them up during this time because black men are needed now more than ever.
I would absolutely agree with that, and certainly even with a young adult daughter, she just graduated from Howard University, third generation HBCU, I would say, but still there are some difficult lessons that need to be taught to our children by our black families, specifically, yes, black fathers, and it's still an uphill climb and something to be concerned about, no question. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to CNN political commentator and author of the new book, My Vanishing Country, Bakari Sellers. We're going to take a little break, but we want to remind you that you can hear this podcast and all of the others in their entirety every night, right before 9 o'clock. Of course, the information is posted on our website on whur.com. We certainly don't want you to miss any of the information that we are sharing with you during the course of these incredible programs. So please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, channel 141. The original Quiet Storm is next on WHUR. This conversation continues with Bakari Sellers on Sirius XM, channel 141, in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we continue our discussion with Bakari Sellers, CNN political commentator and author of the new book, My Vanishing Country. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One of the other things, you're a Southerner, and you are, you know, you're practicing law in Columbia. What else is happening? What are the kinds of issues related to race, racial injustice that are just below the surface that haven't risen to that national recognition that you're observing in South Carolina?
I mean, so that's a good question. It's something that I write about in My Vanishing Country because, you know, a lot of these issues that we're addressing, people often ask me, what is the most pressing concern in your community? And I'm like, we don't have a most. We don't have an if. They are all number one, right? So Denmark, South Carolina, where I'm from, we got three stoplights and a blinking light. It's home to two HBCUs, Voorhees College and Denmark Technical College. It's in a food desert where you can't go, you know, 2 and 3 miles and get access to fresh fruits and vegetables. You know, you talk about access to quality care. We don't have access to a hospital. Our rural hospital shut down and closed in 2010. And what you're seeing is a lot of southern states that didn't expand Medicaid, their hospitals are shutting down. And imagine if you have to go 30 to 45 minutes to the nearest hospital. You don't have potable water. So just think about the water you're drinking and the air you're breathing in is dirty. And then it's along a corridor called the Corridor of Shame where kids go to school and their heating and air don't work and their infrastructure is falling apart. So we don't have a biggest or most, but these have been the structural. You overlay that with the pandemic, it's not any secret why black folk are dying when you talk about these systemic injustice, which lead to these comorbidities. And so these are the same issues we've been yelling about for decades. And, you know, we want them desperately to change. And so those are the concerns that I think when people are talking about today and overflow in the streets, I remind people often, we're not in the streets just because of George Floyd. We're not in the streets just because of Ahmaud Arbery or Breonna Taylor. We're in the streets because of all of those things, plus 401 years of systemic injustice and institutionalized racism. And those are very pervasive in the communities in which I'm from, and those, especially those forgotten communities in the rural South.
Let me go to the phone lines. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Charles calling from Bowie. Charles, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, good afternoon. I'm a native South Carolinian. I want to know what Carly's take is on Senator Tim Scott. He made the comment that the United States is not a racist country. And I know that Tim Scott wasn't selected by the people. He was nominated by the governor, Nikki Haley. And I just wanted to know what McCarvey take on him.
Mm, interesting. Go right ahead.
Good question. So Tim was actually appointed by Nikki during his first when he emerged from the first seat congressional district. And then we ran the same year, and he actually won his seat in 2014 to serve the remainder of the term. And then he actually won an election again in 2018, I believe, to serve a full term, or 2016, excuse me, to serve a full term. So he's been elected twice. Tim is the first African-American elected in South Carolina since Reconstruction. The only reason I know that is because both he and I ran for that same goal in 2014. I actually have a good relationship with Tim. Tim is a friend of mine. I know we're living in an era where people don't have friends on the other side of the aisle, but Tim's a friend of mine. With that, I also say that the bill that Tim Scott put up yesterday, we have a saying in South Carolina that when something is worthless, it's as good as an ashtray on a motorcycle. That's about as good as Tim's bill was yesterday. I'll push my friends to do better. And for Tim to say there's no systemic racism, that is an interesting perspective and worldview, especially on a day where we remember our, a friend of both Tim and I. We both served with Clem in the South Carolina General Assembly and 8 others who were killed in the church. We are a country that was built by black folk. Let me tell you something unique about systemic racism and how deep race is in our country.
Mm-hmm.
My book is a New York Times bestseller for 3 weeks in a row, and it is one of the pinnacles and highlights of my life. And when people ask me to sign this book, do you realize I sign a name that's not my own? That it's a name that's given to me. Sellers is a name that's given to me by the people who owned my family. And many of us, and when we think about our last names, our last names come from those individuals who owned us, whether or not it was the coast of Charleston, like my family, or the coast of Virginia, like some of those people further up north. That's how deep and pervasive the issue of race is. It reminds me of what Al Sharpton said in the funeral of George Floyd. And so, I think that Tim Scott was flat out wrong about his assessment. But I also want you to know politically in South Carolina, Tim Scott's going to be a United States senator as long as he wants to be.
Why do you say that?
One, it's very, very difficult for a Democrat to win in South Carolina. We're praying and hoping that Jamie Harrison can pull off an upset against Lindsey Graham. But the Republican Party would do absolutely anything it can in its power to insulate Tim in a primary, so he won't have that. And, the uphill battle that you have, South Carolina is a ruby red state, and it would just be extremely difficult for anyone to beat a Republican who is that formidable and been a United States senator since the year 2014.
Charles, thank you so much for your phone call. Not to belabor the Tim Scott issue, but I do have a question about that, because I remember very well, and I'm sure you remember also, the story that he has frequently told about how he was held. And when I say held, I don't mean accosted or anything like that, but held in, stopped in place in the U.S. Senate because the guards there did not believe that he was a U.S. senator. And the rigmarole that was required for him to prove that he was who he was. And yet, when you have that and you talk about race, and then you have this, as you say, ashtray on a motorcycle moment or bill yesterday, I just find it hard to really understand the balance that when the issue is put in your face and you still don't seem to believe it, is that him or is that politics?
I mean, you probably got the wrong guest on to answer that question. You probably would have to ask Tim, and Tim would actually answer it and come in the show and sit in the seat and respond to that, because he's not as he doesn't lack the courage that many of his colleagues lack. I think that it's a combination of both, but Tim believes everything he says now. He's not someone who speaks out of one side of his mouth for the purpose of politics. He truly believes it. Tim was brought up by a single mom who took care of him, and you know, he had a owner of a Chick-fil-A who brought him under his wing and you know, kind of guided him through. He has an amazing story. I served with Tim for 2 or 4 years. I can't recall how long he was in the South Carolina State House, but we did serve together. He came in 2010. I got elected in 2006. So we used to make him buy us lunch and stuff because he was still a young freshman in the State House. It's amazing how things change. But he's someone who believes what he says, and I don't have anything personal against Tim Scott. Our politics are vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll text him and tell him, or call him and tell him how I feel, and he'll do the same with me. I genuinely believe that Tim Scott wants black folk to do well in this country. I just think he has a perverse way of getting there.
I want to talk to you about, you know, the next couple of months and your view of what has happened to, you know, the Republican Party, and specifically as we move, you know, forward and look at these issues. I remember when John McCain ran for president, and there was always this discussion about the big tent. We really don't hear a lot about that now. And it seems that there is this cold civil war. This is not the Republican Party. This is Trump's party. And we've got Black Lives Matter over here. What does all of this portend for November in your mind?
I don't know the answer to that. I got out of the prognostication business when I told people that Hillary Clinton was going to get 330 electoral votes. And I was wrong. I think, though, that the answer to the question lies in one thing, and it doesn't lie in, you know, the Trump-Obama voters, which are a unicorn, in my opinion. For me, it lies in the 4 million people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 who didn't come out in 2016. We have to remember, there were a lot of voters who didn't choose Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. They chose the couch. And if we're not careful, those same voters will choose the couch again, particularly black men. And so I am someone who believes that we have to energize the base, and we have to give people a reason to come out and vote. I'm not Donald Trump. That's why I wasn't mad at Puff or Charlamagne. If, you know, some people may say that their comments may have been inarticulate or they didn't communicate it the best way. Whatever you say, that's fine. But they wanted an agenda for black Americans, and I have no problem with that. Evangelicals ask the Republican Party to put forth an agenda every single year. The NRA asked for an agenda. The Federalist Society asked for an agenda. The pro-life movement asked for an agenda. So I have no concerns when black folk ask for an agenda. You know, for me, I just think that if we're able to do something about those 4 million, over a third of which were black folk, then this race will be won, and it will be won handily. If we don't, then Donald Trump will be president for another 4 years.
Are you at least encouraged, for example, by the resignation of apparently clear-eyed thinking Republicans such as Mary Elizabeth Taylor, the Assistant Secretary of State for Legislative Affairs, when people speak out even within the party?
Yeah, I guess I'm that, you know, I don't give people participation trophies, to be honest with you. I really don't. And so the question is, you know, like I said, you know, the scripture, it's faith without works. And so what works is she going to do beyond speaking out? I mean, that is one thing. But we're hoping that she continues to press forward and does more. Mm.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Bakari Sellers, congratulations on the book, My Vanishing Country. I hope this is just one of many. I think you still have a lot to say, even at the sage age of, what did you say, 35? Thank you. And look, whenever you're ready to talk daughters, you know, I promise you, based on my daughter, it does get better. So hang in there.
I hope everybody goes out and copy, but thank you for this opportunity. I'll have a blessed evening.
You too. I really appreciate it. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, June 18th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nia Hurd-Garris with today's tip for kids from the American Academy of Pediatrics. Babies younger than 6 months don't sleep for very long at a time, which means their parents don't either. But with practice, babies can get into a safe sleep routine. Remember, the safest place for your baby to sleep for every nap and every sleep is on their back in a bassinet, crib, or play yard. Knowing your baby is safe should help you sleep more soundly. For more on safe sleep, talk with your pediatrician or visit healthychildren.org.
Did you know 22 Americans die each day waiting for organ transplants, most of them for kidneys? The good news is that MatchingDonors.com is helping to change that. MatchingDonors.com is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that links organ donors with people in desperate need of kidneys and other transplants. And now you don't need to donate a kidney to save a life. You can donate your boat, car, or real estate, with 100% of the proceeds going to help save the lives of people needing organ transplants. Visit MatchingDonors.com or call 800-385-0422. Americans die each day waiting for organ transplants, most of them for kidneys. The good news is that MatchingDonors.com is helping to change that. MatchingDonors.com is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that links organ donors with people in desperate need of kidneys and other transplants. And now you don't need to donate a kidney to save a life. You can donate your boat, car, or real estate, with 100% of the proceeds going to help save the lives of people needing organ transplants. Visit MatchingDonors.com or call 800-385-0422.
Now, more of 96.3 WHUR's community coronavirus coverage.
Hello.